This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Harvard professor Michael Sandel has become famous for helping us think about moral dilemmas. Why do we make certain choices and what's our rationale? In his new book, What Money Can't Buy, he turns his attention to the market economy. Should we rethink the way that we price, well, just about everything, from standing in line to fighting wars? Are there things that we should not be able to pay for, things just too sacred for price tags? Should we create a new way to view the economy? And I'm joined here in the studio by Michael Sandel, the Anne T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard, and the author of What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. Michael Sandel, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Kara.
So you mentioned a lot of things, everything from a surrogate mother that's up for sale to skipping rush hour traffic. And I wonder, we're going to get into some of those things. Was there a moment, was there a particular service that you saw that triggered you, that got you to write this book?
I've been thinking about this book for the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. I would like to be able to say it all came after the financial crisis when we saw that markets and morals had become disconnected. But I've actually been thinking about this for some time and assembling all these examples about the different walks of life where markets and market values have been making an incursion. I think over really the past three decades, a period of what you might call market triumphalism.
And you talk a little bit about Ronald Reagan, maybe, and Margaret Thatcher being part of this and sort of saying that markets are the solution.
Yes, they brought in this idea as an explicit ideology. But what's interesting is that even after they passed from the political scene, their successors, who were left-of-center figures, Tony Blair in Britain, Bill Clinton in the U.S., they moderated but consolidated the faith that markets are the primary instrument for achieving the public good. They didn't challenge the fundamental premise. And so what's happened ever since is that market thinking, economic reasoning, and market values have begun to infiltrate almost every sphere of life, not only to do with buying and selling material goods, their traditional sphere.
So let me take you back to that crisis of 2008. You're already thinking about this book and the issues that are involved in it, and you're watching markets fail. You're watching firms collapsing, an auto bailout, bank bailout. What did that lead you to think, to sort of conclude about markets as you're watching this all unfold?
Two things. First, that markets by themselves, unregulated, don't serve the public good very well. I think most people came to that conclusion. I also thought a second thing, though. I thought now, finally, after this three-decade period of market faith, we would have a real public debate about where markets serve the public good and where they don't belong. And what's striking is that even after the financial crisis brought our economy to the brink, we did not really have that debate. The terms of political argument didn't really change. We had some debate about deregulation, but no fundamental debate about the role of markets in a good society.
So I want to get into that for a minute. I'm going to dip back into history because you sort of talk about 2008 as being the end of 80 years of general prosperity. And of course, the other bookend of that 80 years is the Great Depression. So let me play a clip for you of Franklin Roosevelt's 1933 inauguration. And you will hear him in this very first clip talk about the practices of the unscrupulous money changers.
Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization.
And one more clip here, also from the 33 inauguration. This is FDR sort of talking about pulling away from a totally free market, the idea of that, you know, people should not be able to bet without supervision, especially when they're using your money. So
right.
Let's listen.
This nation is asking for action, and action now. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credit and investment. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money.
Michael Sandel, when you look back at the response to the Great Depression and then the response to, let's call it, the Great Recession, how do you see these marked differences emerging?
Aren't they dramatic?
They really are.
The clips you just played are surprising even to me. I had forgotten the language, how morally robust was FDR's critique of the excesses of markets and especially of financial markets. Think how unimaginable it would be today to hear any mainstream politician, and FDR was certainly a mainstream political figure, use that kind of language today. The difference is, today we've accepted, almost without realizing it, a kind of technocratic managerial language in politics. And when it's a breath of fresh air, really, to hear FDR bringing moral passion to bear on economic questions. And we've lost, for the most part, we've lost the ability in our public discourse to do that.
Well, and you ask in the book, is there anything that we shouldn't be putting a price on? And one of the interesting things that came out of Social Security and then decades later, the idea of Medicare and Medicaid is that, well, maybe your health or your ability to eat, let's say, in old age, we shouldn't leave that up to market forces.
Right.
I mean, that was an interesting premise,
yes.
I mean, of Social Security.
Yes, and it was the result of a political debate and of a kind of revolution. It was the creation, really, of the American welfare state. And what the welfare state did was to take certain fundamental human needs out of the market. It was never as full a welfare state as was achieved in European democracies. We've had the lingering debate over health care ever since, up through the Obama administration. But it did represent a resolve to make certain things not subject to market allocation and market valuation. Health, education, security, and retirement among them. And what we're seeing now is really an erosion of that settlement. We've had a very hesitant extension of the welfare state with the healthcare reform. Very hesitant,
mm-hmm.
Partial, still a step in the right direction.
Highly contested.
Highly contested. But now Paul Ryan has proposed to turn Medicare into a voucher system, which is taking a step back toward the direction of marketizing healthcare during retirement. And in so many areas of life, health, education, the environment, the way we fight our wars, the way we educate our children, we have moved more and more, almost without realizing it, in the direction of market assumptions, treating all goods as if they were commodities.
Now, do you see some things as, let's say, the police department, the fire department, as parts, in a way, of that welfare state where they say, essentially, if your house is burning down, we're not going to wait to see whether you can afford to have people bring water to the house,
right,
to put the fire out. If you're a rich person, your house is burning down. You're a poor person, your house is burning down. Regardless, we're going to come help you.
And yet, in growing numbers of communities today, there is greater and greater reliance on private fire companies. And there was an episode a couple of years ago where a house was on fire. It may have been in Tennessee, if I remember correctly. The owner of the house had not subscribed to the private fire department. And so the fire department came, stood by while his house burned, just to make sure it didn't spread to a subscriber's house. So what we're seeing is an individuation of goods, even fire protection, as the market comes increasingly to govern these areas of life, including police and fire protection.
So I want to ask you why that is. We talked a little bit about the Depression, and now let's go back to 2008, to that other bookend that you set up. I talked fairly recently to a colleague of yours, a Harvard professor, Theda Skocpol, who has recently written a book about the Tea Party, which you cite, too, as having interestingly grown out of the 2008 crisis, but the Tea Party's response, let's say unlike FDR's response, was we need market-based solutions. So I asked Theda Skocpol, what were the complaints of the people who joined the Tea Party? What did she hear from them? Let's listen.
Well, they would always name Obamacare, the health care reform. They didn't usually mention mortgages, but they would certainly talk about this idea of freeloaders were going to get, that Obama was going to be doing things for freeloaders or moochers. And so we wanted to know who are the moochers and the freeloaders, and we let people talk. And it, undocumented immigrants, illegal immigrants, very big. In fact, I would probably say at the grassroots of the Tea Party, that's the most intense. The feeling that the country's being invaded by people who, if you listen, turn out to be Latino, who are taking taxpayer-funded services. But in addition, you would hear stories about welfare that sound very much like conservative themes for a long time and were clearly referring to African Americans. And then finally, the most interesting, young people. The idea that the government might start doing things for young people, sometimes like their grandniece or nephew or their grandchild who was just staying at home and didn't have a job.
Michael Sandel, what motivated this turn towards market solutions, in your view, from the Tea Party coming out of a sort of market crisis in 2008?
I think one of the intriguing things about the Tea Party movement is that it bears certain similarities to the Occupy movement, which is at the opposite end of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain kind of anger and resentment and moral outrage that fueled both movements, and I think it has a common source in the bailouts and the way the bailouts were handled. The bailouts were very unpopular with the public. They generated a sense of populist outrage because I think everybody knew that here were big, powerful financial firms and banks, Wall Street companies, that had made huge amounts of money when times were good. And when it went bad, the taxpayer had to subsidize them, and very little was asked in return. Very little accountability was demanded in terms of lending, in terms of public representation on the boards, in terms of not lobbying against regulation to prevent this happening again. Very little was asked of them. I think that tainted the Obama. Obama came in having mobilized this great moral and civic idealism and sense of aspiration. It was tamped down and muted, I think, Obama's moral voice in his handling of the bailout, which, of course, began under the Republican administration. But that unresolved sense of moral outrage that the banks and Wall Street were bailed out and very little was asked of them, I think has animated lingering resentment across the political spectrum, and I think it fueled the Tea Party movement and the Occupy movement.
And yet, you do not see the rhetoric, you do from the Occupy movement, from the Tea Party movement, though, and certainly even during the general campaign, whether it be on the Democratic side or on the Republican side, you don't see a lot of rhetoric directed against the very rich, against Wall Street bankers who still have a house in the Hamptons, but presided over firms that no longer exist.
Right. I think that's true. In fact, polls have shown after the financial crisis that in public opinion, they hold government in lower esteem than the banks, the federal government. Now, why should that be?
Mm-hmm.
It's the banks that failed. And so it is something to reckon with politically. I think it's because government did not stand up in a strong enough way to the banks and to the financial institutions. It was seen as their instrument, almost, under both administrations, Republican and then Democratic.
You're almost looking for some FDR language in standing up to the sort of, as he calls them, as FDR did, the money changers.
Yes, I think ideally what we should have had after the financial crisis was a moral and political debate about what forms of finance are socially useful, contribute to the public good, and what forms do not, but simply enrich the people who engage in them and create great risks for the rest of us. We've not really had that debate, and we certainly have not had the broader debate that I'm trying to encourage with this book, of looking at our society, across our society, and asking, where do markets belong? Where do they serve the public good? And where might markets actually undermine or corrupt social goods and civic goods that should be governed by other values, whether it's to do with organ sales or surrogacy you mentioned earlier on, whether it has to do with the way we fight our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. There were more paid military contractors on the ground than there were U.S. military troops. Now, this isn't because we had a public debate about whether we wanted to outsource war to private companies. It just happened. And similar things have been happening throughout our social life and public life over these past 30 years. And what I think is the great missing debate in our politics is a morally engaged, morally robust debate in the kind of language you heard from FDR about where markets do good, and there are many places where they do great good, in generating prosperity and affluence, organizing productive activity, and where markets don't belong, where market values may be insidious or corrupting or corrosive of moral goods and civic goods worth caring about.
We're talking to Michael Sandel, the Anne T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard. He's the author of What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. And Michael Sandel, let's talk a little bit about that stratification that we see in society, partially right. because so many things now do have a price on them.
Right.
And here's a very simple one that you offer in the book. In an airport, if you're flying first class or business class, you very often don't have to stand the same kind of lines. And we could take it one step further. If you're rich enough to not fly out of a commercial airport and you can, you know, afford a net jet, which is like a shared jet, or you can afford your own jet, you may not have to go through security. Forget waiting in any lines or dealing with parking at all. What is the corrosive effect of not having to stand in line when you go to the airport?
Well, looking just at airports, it might seem like a relatively small thing. And then we look one step further and notice that something similar is happening in amusement parks there, too. Unlike the old days, you don't have to stand in the long lines waiting for the rides in most amusement parks. You can buy a VIP pass and go to the head of the line.
That really surprised me. Things have really changed since I was at Universal Studios.
Okay, so we've got airports and amusement parks. Still, people might say, yeah, but these are small things. Well, then what about when you look at the line-standing companies that have arisen in Washington, D.C.? When they hold congressional hearings, a certain number of seats are set aside for the public on a first-come, first-served basis. A lot of lobbyists want to attend those hearings, but they don't want to stand on long lines, especially in the dead of winter or in the rain. And so there's now a new cottage industry in Washington. Lobbyists can hire line-standing companies who will go out and hire homeless people or others to stand in those lines. The lobbyists pay the company a handsome fee, and just before the hearing begins, they come claim their place in the line. And in they go. So it may look small when you look at one or two examples, airports, amusement parks, but do we really want access to congressional hearings or to Supreme Court arguments? You can hire the line-standing companies to hear a Supreme Court oral argument. Do we really want access to representative government to be allocated according to the highest bidder? And so what I'm suggesting is we need to look at social life as a whole, at the creeping commodification that has been unfolding, and really step back and ask whether we want to live this way or whether it isn't ultimately damaging to the commonality, the shared experience, the sense that we're all in this together, that democratic citizenship requires.
Now, has Congress, has the Supreme Court, have they expressed any concern that what used to be sort of a little bit of a democratic right, that if you got up at 5 a.m. and you really wanted to hear the Supreme Court arguments on X, you could do that, that has been sort of corrupted?
Well, there have been some voices raised against this. In fact, Senator Claire McCaskill when she first entered the Senate, noticed this and was appalled by it. She introduced legislation to prevent it, but the legislation has gone nowhere. Here's one area of life that I think sums up the corrosive effect on commonality. A baseball stadium. When I was a kid, I've always been a baseball fan. I grew up in Minnesota. I'm a Red Sox fan now. I've been here for some years. But I would go watch the Minnesota Twins play. The difference in price between the best box seat and the cheapest seat in the bleachers, what do you guess it was?
I don't know. Maybe it was four times as expensive to sit in the best seats?
It was $3.50 for a box seat and $1 for the bleachers.
Okay, okay.
You're pretty close.
Okay.
But that's only $2.50.
Right.
The result was that going to the ballpark was a place where you would find CEOs and the mailroom clerks sitting side by side. Everyone ate the same soggy hot dogs and drank the same stale beer. Everyone had to wait in long lines for the restroom. And everyone got rained on. It got wet when it rained.
Mm-hmm.
There was and in the midst of it, everyone was pulling for the home team. It's different now. Over the last couple of decades, almost every stadium, and this is true of professional stadiums and even college stadiums, have skyboxes that separate the upper crust from those in the stands below, from the common folk. And now it's no longer true that when you go to a baseball game, everyone gets wet when it rains. And this is symbolic, I think, of what's happening throughout our society. I call it the skyboxification of American life.
Now, you know, you talk in the book about, well, some people might argue, look, if somebody's willing to pay what it costs to sit in the box seats, to sit in the skybox, they must really, really want to be there, right? I mean, they're shelling out, let's say, $1,000. But then you say you've noticed something really interesting, which is when you go to baseball games, very often the people in the best seats get there late and they leave early.
Yes.
And so, okay, so if you're paying $1,000 for your seat, why would you get there late and leave early?
Well, because it reflects your ability to pay more than it does reflect your love of the game. So what this illustrates is the standard economic reasoning, which says an efficient allocation of goods or seats to a baseball game or to a rock concert should be governed by the market, because markets allocate goods efficiently, namely according to the willingness to pay. That's only true up to a point. The important qualification is the willingness and the ability to pay. So there may be other systems of distribution for rock concerts or baseball games or attending lectures or, for that matter, attending universities that should not wholly be governed by market principles or, for that matter, access to hospitals. Sometimes the principle of queuing, first come, first serve, is more fair than markets. Sometimes the principle of need, who really needs to see the doctor in the emergency room first. And so I think we have to look case by case, good by good, social practice by social practice, and have a public debate about where market principles should govern and where other values should govern.
I want to get to the issue of healthcare in a minute, which you touched on, but even if we stay with these things that seem trivial, like standing in congressional lines or, you know, sitting in the box seats at a baseball game,
right,
or, you know, or skipping the line at the airport, I wonder if there's somebody who has enough money that they never stand in lines at airports, and they don't eat soggy hot dogs, they really have a good, you know, they have really good food, right, they never stand in line for the bathroom at the baseball game, do they go through life believing life to be fundamentally different than the other person? And let's say that person, let's just say, is the CEO of an airport.
Right.
Do they believe the experience in an airport to be a good one? Because for them, it has been, even though for 98% of people, it's terrible.
I think there's a risk that this can happen. And perhaps the biggest risk is when we look at our system of public education. As public education systems struggle those who can buy their way out. And that's perfectly understandable, not wanting to make their children hostages to a civic experiment if the schools are really bad. It's understandable. And yet, it does take a toll on the commonality that democracy requires. And especially if this effect of the affluent buying their way out of common experiences and circumstances, especially if this is true for health and education and for military service, how many children of the affluent or of the powerful fought and died in Iraq and Afghanistan? Some did, but they were, but the proportions are vastly out of line with the general population.
And we saw something very different, for example, in World War II.
Yes. And so what happens as market triumphalism gradually works its way throughout our society is that we look up and we find that after a time we live and work and shop and play in different places. We send our children to different schools. I think this is not just unfair to those who are left with bad public schools. I think it corrupts something important about a shared civic life that actually harms those who can inhabit the skyboxes. I think if we had a kind of politics, the politics of the common good, that recalled people from their skyboxes, tried to create good public schools that everyone would want to use, public parks, recreation areas, public transportation that everyone would want to use, I think even those of us who may inhabit the skyboxes would actually be happier. We would experience, I think, a richer kind of democratic life. So I don't think it's only a matter of unfairness to those at the bottom. I also think it corrupts something that's central to what it is to be a democratic citizen.
It's unfair all around somehow. I'm Kara Miller. I'm joined by Michael Sandel, professor of government at Harvard and the author of What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. Several years ago, in the New York Times, Jared Diamond, a professor at UCLA, wrote an op-ed that really made an impression on me. I'm going to read you just a couple of lines of it. And he says very much what you just talked about. He's speaking from being in Los Angeles, and he says, I drive by gated communities guarded by private security patrols and filled with people who drink bottled water, depend on private pensions, and send their children to private schools. By doing these things, they lose the motivation to support the police force, the municipal water supply, Social Security, and public schools. If conditions deteriorate too much for poorer people, gates will not keep the rioters out. And he's sort of looking at the downfall of societies, and he worries right. that when the experience of the many gets too far from the experience yes. of the few, that's yes. a real problem. Do you see that as yes. also a problem?
Yes. What happens is the affluent lose a stake in public things. And however well-intentioned they may be, if their lives and their children's lives are not somehow connected to the public realm, whether we're talking about public transportation or playgrounds or parks or recreation facilities or health clinics or public schools, if the affluent don't have a stake in those things, then it will be very difficult to support them. I was a British friend of mine, a senior British politician, Shirley Williams. I was having lunch with her once, and the person came to the table and said, bottled water or tap water? And her answer was, she said, tap water. We worked too long and too hard to get safe, clean tap water for everyone in this country. She was in Britain, to have some of us be drinking bottled water now. I was struck by that. She brought her philosophy right to the dining room table. But it reflects this sense that if everyone has a stake in public goods, then public life will go better.
You know, okay, so let's talk about healthcare, which has been so central to the debate over recent years. And we also, just in terms of numbers, are facing a huge sort of deficit of primary care physicians. you talk in the book about this concept of concierge medicine, where you can pay $1,500 or substantially more in some cases a year to get the cell phone of your doctor, to get access to your doctor without having to wait. You know, many of us will call up and say, I need a physical. And they say, well, we can get you in like 3.5 months.
Right.
But this is a kind of medicine where there, like the airport, there are no lines. So what has spurred the rise in concierge medicine?
I think initially what spurs it is the desire, the frustration of everyone, physicians and patients alike, with the short, rushed appointments that primary caregivers are almost forced to give their patients by the system of reimbursement by health insurance companies that undervalues primary care medicine. But instead of trying to deal with that problem globally, as a big public policy question, what has happened is people have just opted out, those who can afford it, and we've seen the advent of concierge, sometimes called boutique medical practices, where primary care physicians will radically cut their patient rosters to the select few who can afford to pay an annual retainer fee, sometimes up to $25,000 a year, in exchange for the benefits, the quick appointments that you described, the cell phone numbers and so on. So it's an understandable reaction, but an unfortunate one, to a problem that should be dealt with head on as a problem for our society, how to give greater value to primary care medicine. And instead, those who can opt out do, and the rest are then crowded into the clinics and to the practices that remain open.
And one of the really interesting questions, to come back to something we were talking before, is if the CEO of GE, if he and his family all have concierge medicine, and then he is asked, well, what kinds of plans, what kinds of options should we give to the employees, the thousands and thousands of employees of GE? It becomes an academic question to him. He doesn't really understand the difference between this kind of PPO and this kind of HMO, because that's not what his family has ever dealt with. It's just options on a piece of paper with numbers attached to them, and no real sense of how hard it might be to convince a provider to reimburse them for something.
Yes, it becomes very abstract, so that even the best intentioned, most conscientious officials or heads of companies live a life that draws them from actual experience of the challenges faced by everybody else.
Let's touch briefly on places like Harvard, where you are. You talk about the idea of being able to essentially buy your way in to private universities. And the argument of the private university is, well, look, we're private. We have things we have to pay for, like buildings and professorships and scholarships. And so we need money from people who can afford to pay. What's your view of the idea of there being a certain number of seats maybe that are set aside for people who just have a lot of money, not necessarily the best qualified people?
I should emphasize that I was presenting this as a hypothetical,
okay,
not as an actual description of what goes on. The idea of whether a university should auction off a certain number of seats to raise money to pay for scholarships. That was a philosopher's hypothetical. So let me emphasize that. But there are critics of elite universities who say that by giving, for example, advantage to legacies, the children of alumni when they apply, that this has the effect of giving an advantage to applicants, many of whose parents have contributed financially to a university, or who could in the future. And that debate really does need to be set alongside the debate we've had for some time about affirmative action. Some would say that the case for affirmative action is strengthened by the existence of other kinds of preferences to alumni children or children of the affluent, if indeed that is what is happening. So I think that we need really to step back and think hard about both of those questions and in the role of money and markets in allocating access to higher education.
A whole other discussion, but a very interesting one. We've been talking about what it means to move from a market economy to a market society with Michael Sandel, a professor of government at Harvard. His latest book is What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. Michael Sandel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kara.
And Callie Crossley is making her way back into Studio 3.
Kara, are you one of the people eager to buy the new iPhone?
I would be if I wasn't under a 2-year contract with my current phone.
Got it. Well, our tech expert Hiawatha Bray is here to give us a lowdown on what the new iPhone has to offer. I'm Callie Crossley.
I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.